It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
With the passing of Wicomico County Executive Bob Culver, the direction of the county will be in the hands of another. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Bob Culver was only the second county executive of Wicomico, and with his passing, the county's search for a successor will begin in earnest. But there is no obvious successor, and whoever it is must be of the same political party, in this case, a Republican. And the county council has 45 days to appoint a successor, making that deadline September 9th. And that person will serve until the 2022 election. All of this comes as, of course, the region has been hit this week with tornadoes and high winds. And on the phone to assess where the county is going, we have Greg Bassett. He is the editor and general manager of the Salisbury Independent. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Don.
By the way, did you survive the weather? What was the outcome there?
I was lucky, and I actually got to go out in the middle of it. I had a friend who needed to have eye surgery, so I had to go to Princess Anne to pick them up at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I was out driving right in the middle of it. It was very exciting.
So let's turn to the incident, which I understand took place, which is the finance director of Wicomico County, Michelle Innes. She has left the county, her position. What's the background on that?
Well, she's the former human resources director for the county who was promoted by Bob Culver to become the finance director. And the county council never approved her as a department head under their rules in the charter in terms of they're allowed to verify someone who's, you know, affirm someone who's been appointed. So her position in that job was certainly complicated and controversial from the beginning. But now that Mr. Culver has passed and Mr. John Pesota is in charge as both the acting county executive and the county administrator, director of administration, apparently he was able to persuade Ms. Ennis to leave, or there was some sort of action in which she left the building yesterday.
So describe for me some of the controversy surrounding her.
I think she was kind of a polarizing figure. There was an incident earlier in her tenure where the county executive had given her a raise, and it was only discovered through an audit, so that made some council members perturbed. But mostly, it was just a situation where they did not, for whatever reason, and they don't talk about personnel stuff because it opens them to some serious court situations, but they just did not have confidence in her, and they did not want her to be the finance director. So they never approved her. In fact, they even went to the extent of voting to not approve her, even though her name had not been submitted.
By the way, finally, do you get any sense about why the county folks on the county council, I think almost unanimously, said no to her?
That I don't know. I mean, I just hear gossip type stuff, but there was some sort of situation where they didn't feel like that she was a legitimate person. And I know that they definitely, in terms of process, felt like they hadn't been involved like they were supposed to be under the charter.
So let's turn to Bob Culver and his passing. What do you think, by the way, first of all, Bob Culver's legacy is going to be?
That's interesting. I think Bob took a big picture approach to things. He was certainly hands-on. We had a situation with the first county executive really relied on his administration to do things, and he seemed more of a figurehead. I mean, he would get in there and he would make hard decisions, but Bob was at his desk all the time every day making lots and lots of decisions. And he worked very closely with Wayne Strasburg, the director of administration, and they did a lot of things. I think his success on this most recent thing, the Field 7.5, the field for disabled youth at the Henry Parker Complex, will be a legacy. He wanted to develop Pirates Wharf down near Whitehaven as a camp area, as a recreational area. Getting alcohol into the Civic Center, that was a third rail issue in Wicomico politics for a long time. No one was willing to step up and enforce the alcohol issue into the Civic Center. He did that successfully. And he was actually able to build quite a good reserve fund and a rainy day fund for the county. They were very, very focused in terms of their spending. He was not eager to spend on anything. He fought spending a lot and then ultimately gave in on some things like the West Salisbury School, the third phase of the James M. Bennett expansion, things that he tried to oppose when he first came in. But he ended up giving in on it, and those things progressed. So I think he's got a pretty good legacy. He was certainly, I don't want to say he was petty, but, yeah, he was kind of petty on some things in terms of, using his power as the executive. He wanted people to come to him and ask him for things as opposed to go to them and work some sort of an arrangement or, you know, a bargain. He really wanted to be the guy in charge. He saw that as his job, and he protected that very mightily.
Do you think he's changed the nature of the county executive position?
I still think it's one of those jobs that you can do whatever you want to do with it. You can ride around in the county car and cut ribbons, or you can really get in there and do the hard work. I think that will be the option for whoever takes this job next. Both executives sort of did it in a different way. Certainly Rick Pollitt was very affable and, you know, very political. Bob was very political in another sense. The charter really doesn't say exactly how the person should conduct themselves. It just says what they're responsible for, and it's really up to them how to do it.
So what's the process now going forward in terms of selecting a new county executive?
Well, as you said, the county council is taking applications for this, which is kind of bizarre. I didn't think they would do an application process. I thought they would just sort of huddle in secret and make a decision. But they're taking applications through August 11th, which is Tuesday, which ironically is also the same day that Mr. Culver will have a memorial service at the Civic Center in Salisbury at 1 o'clock. And then I guess they'll get down to the hard work of going through the applicants and deciding who they're going to pick. As you said, it has to be someone who is Republican. They have until September 9th to make the decision. And that person will be the county executive until the 2022 election. So it would fill the rest of the term for Mr. Culver. Lots of intrigue in terms of what they do. It will be a Republican, obviously, but do the Democrats, the Republicans have a 4-3 majority on the council. Do the Democrats want to appoint just a placeholder, you know, someone who won't run for re-election in 2022 or someone who would be weak in an election situation? You know, do they want to appoint the weakest person in terms of just for politics? Do the Republicans want to appoint someone who will be very aggressive and be able to run for re-election? But do they also want to appoint someone who, like Mr. Culver, didn't really want to work and play with them? Do they want to appoint someone that will be more susceptible to their demands, someone who's more like them, who will understand, who will want to work and play with them? So there's a lot of intrigue that will happen here in the next 2 weeks.
So turning to some potential successors, the name certainly that came to my mind first, of course, was John Cannon. He's the council vice president, was president for a while of the council, has some rental interests, management interests in terms of the city and the county. What's the prospect for him?
I would think it would be pretty good. Now, here's the situation. Now he's got his colleagues there that he works with on the council. And he was, until this year, he was president of the county council. Now he is the vice president. He stepped down from the president's role, he said, because he needed to focus more on his business. His business needed more of his time. So for him to put the business aside and become the county executive, I think would be difficult. It would require a big change in his lifestyle, in his professional and personal lifestyle. But at the same time, he's had to talk hard to these people as their leader. He's had to try to whip them, to vote in certain ways. He's had to administer them. So are they feeling all warm and fuzzy for John? Do they want him to be the county executive, or have there been past problems there that they don't want to reward him for? So that could be an awkward situation in terms of him getting it, in terms of him getting selected. Now, you could argue he only needs 3 votes because he can vote for himself. And I pursued this legally that, you know, the charter says clearly that a county council member can vote on any issue that is before the county council. It doesn't matter what it is. Now, would he recuse himself because he's voting for himself? Now, they don't do that when they appoint the leadership. You can vote for yourself for council president or council vice president. So there's no reason to think that he would have to recuse himself. So unlike anyone else, in theory, he only needs 3 council votes.
If he were to become, by the way, county executive, how would you compare them then in terms of style, in terms of the sense of the position with, say, somebody like Culver?
John is a very exacting person, and he is a businessman, and he asks lots of really detailed questions in these council meetings, especially on issues of the budget. So he knows how to run a business. He knows, what a P&L looks like and what it should look like. So he knows those processes, and I think he would be very involved. I almost worry that John would want to be too involved in everything because he is so exacting. He might not be able to take, a 30,000 foot view on things. He'll want to really get in there and do the hard work.
Well, turn to Delegate Carl Anderton. He's obviously a former mayor from Del Mar. What do we know about him, and what are the prospects if he particularly leaving, say, his job in Annapolis?
But the thing with Carl that's really interesting right now is Carl, just in the last few days, has made it clear that he really, really wants the job. Hmm. You know, where Cannon has kind of been coy about it, hasn't exactly said what he wants to do yet, either officially or unofficially, you know, he's still sort of mulling it. Carl's out there gathering support. I have a letter to the editor in my paper today from a downtown real estate developer contractor who says that the council should select Mr. Anderton. And he is meeting with members of the business community. He's trying to line up people who support him. He's already told me he's going to make an announcement probably over the weekend that he wants to do this thing. So he's the only person out there who's really seeking the job. I know he toyed with running against Bob Culver in the primary a year and a half ago and decided not to because he would have to give up his House of Delegates seat. But it seems to me that, you know, Carl Anderton is going full gun for this.
Also, there's Matt Holloway, also a member of the council, two terms, fifth-generation farmer. Lots of business interests, particularly when it comes to the agriculture business and the farming community, is seen as a link to them. What about them?
Yeah, Matt's another guy who had been on the council for several years and stepped away because he wanted to focus on his business. He started a greenhouse business growing vegetables, high-quality vegetables indoors. He's got quite the network there. Out where he lives near Hebron, a huge farm, a huge sod farm. So he's been focused on business. And I think while a lot of people would like to see him be the county executive, and maybe someday he will be, he's still pretty young. I think he's like 42, 43. There will be a time perhaps for him. I think he's focused on business now. But from what I'm hearing, he might have his sights set on Addie Eckert's state Senate seat. He might want to be someone in the legislature. That's a job that wouldn't be as time intensive and might suit what he wants to do ultimately.
I also understand that he did work closely with Rick Pollitt, who was a Democrat, for the first county executive.
He did. He crossed party lines. And there was a lot of, certainly the Republican Central Committee and some of the Republicans were unhappy that he embraced Rick. But his attitude was that, you know, Rick was in charge and we need to work with him. You know, you can't work around the guy who's in charge. So he really did work closely with Rick. He was friendly with Rick, and that angered some Republicans. But I think it made him an effective councilman.
The other name that popped out of me and your list was Sheriff Mike Lewis, who, I mean, apparently he's been promotable as before maybe the state Senate, county executive. Some people have, I guess, suggested governor. But it sounds like, to me, Lewis, when I see him, he's quite happy being sheriff.
He is. I think he really enjoys the job. It's certainly what is suited for him. He's done it for a long time now, so it might be time for him to do something different. But does he really want all the problems that the county executive has? Would he rather be in the legislature? Does he want to be an executive? You know, Mike's got a good gig for him to do this. I think he'd have to sacrifice some things personally. So I don't really see him as someone who would do it, but certainly he's very electable. He'd be very powerful. I think he and Karen Lemon actually hold the record now in Wacomico County for getting the most votes over the years. So he is one of the top vote getters, and he would certainly be the top Republican vote getter in Wacomico County of all time.
Also, there's, of course, Council President Larry Dodd. What's his prospects? And he obviously has some strong ties to the Salisbury Fire Department.
Yeah, I think Larry's, Larry, it's one of those things of, you know, if the vote splits between, you know, Cannon and Anderton, you know, maybe Larry's the guy. His colleagues voted him to be their president, so he's got a history of them approving him for something. He is in a retired position. He might want to be county executive, whether he could get the four votes or three votes because he would vote for himself. I'm not sure, but, you know, you have to put his name in it just because he is the head of the legislative branch of the Wacomico County government.
And Delegate Chris Adams.
Adams, again, Republican, a businessman, very focused on his business. I don't know that he would want it, but he's the kind of guy who might be, you know, suited for the job. A lot of business experience. He's pretty right-wing, I guess you would say. He's very conservative in his viewpoint. I think he likes being in the General Assembly, but His general assembly seat is hard. I mean, he represents the western part, the northern and western part of Wicomico, where Wicomico was divided up in reapportionment the last time. So he services constituents all the way out to St. Michael's, you know, very long way away. He's got a big district to prove himself in, and that's certainly time intensive. He's on the road a lot. So maybe he would like to be county executive.
And finally, this name, Joe Olinger, who actually lost to Rick Pollitt by about 912 votes, I guess it is. I remember his candidacy. What about him? Does he have a shot at this? He obviously wants it.
Well, I think he would fall into that placeholder candidacy thing. Now, I think maybe the time has passed for him. He's a little bit older now. He's retired. I know he likes to travel a lot. He had a lot of great ideas when he ran before. He really looked at things in a constructive way. He had a little two-year term on the school board in between, where he was vice president on the school board. He was another one of those people where he had been very critical of the school board, and then he got on the school board and was less critical. You know, once you can look behind the tent and see what's going on, you realize why things are the way they are. So he sort of adapted that way. He's a very serious man, and I think he would do good in the job. Again, he would be one of those people who the Democrats might want because he would be a placeholder. You know, he might not be the best candidate, or he might not even want to run for it in 2022. He might just occupy the office until the next election. So he might be one of those compromised people that the Democrats pick, you know, but again, he's got to raise his hand and put his name in or be encouraged to do it. He would have to apply, and I don't know that Joe's going to do that.
If you were betting on at least the names that we've talked about so far, who do you think would be a front runner?
I think Carl Anderton right now, because he does want it. You know, he is out there trying to get the job, and you can't ever undersell that. It's one thing I've learned in politics. The people who do get out there first and start meeting with people and start trying to gather support, they have an edge up on everyone. There was recently, I saw one of our delegates at an event in a really off time, a weird time of the election of the year, and I was like, why in the world is she there right now? You know, why would she bother to go to this thing? And it came back to me. Someone said, well, if you're going to run against her, you've got to go to all those events too. You've got to be just as dedicated. You have to show your complete commitment. And Carl right now is showing his complete commitment to this. You know, he's willing to perhaps give up his seat. Now, and, you know, he could just do it for the 2 years to still go back and run again for his delegate seat, not being the seated delegate. But at the same time, he's working it hard. And you have to think that counts for something right now.
Because he does sit on the House Appropriations Committee, which is fairly powerful.
Yes, and he's pretty bipartisan. You know, he's gone up there and he's worked with Democrats, and that's been a criticism of him. He's very close to Jake Day, and he works in support of the mayor. And you've got the whole city-county breach out there, you know, in the rural area where the people don't understand Salisbury or think it's too liberal. But he's worked closely with Jake Day. Now, Jake is a Democrat. There's nonpartisan voting in Salisbury, but we all know he's a Democrat. And Carl has been, you know, a pretty moderate Republican. On some things, he's pretty conservative, but on other things, he's pretty moderate. But he's definitely willing to work with anybody.
Does ideology really play that strong a role, do you think, when it comes to local government? Because if you're in local government, one thing you got to do is make things work, no matter what. Governors, obviously, at the national level are now dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, and many Republicans and Democratic governors are trying to figure out doing the same things, trying to figure out what to do. Does that apply, do you think, in local politics?
Well, it's funny. On my PAC 14 show, I just had Phil Tillman on last week, and he was the longtime county council president here. Was on the county council for a long time. And I said, well, you know, Phil, these guys, they don't really declare their party when they make votes. And he was like, he said, really? He goes, go back and look at how these people have voted. They vote 4-3 on a lot of things. The Democrats vote one way and the Republicans vote one way. And I need to go look at that. And he might be right. But I think in terms of issues, if you're talking about the airport or, you know, building a school, there's a lot of consensus stuff. I don't think it really applies to party. But this is politics. This is going to set up, you know, the ultimate leader from a political base, someone who's going to work with this governor and the next governor, you know, in 2 years, work with legislators. So I think it's going to be a really political situation. And people are going to see this in terms of politics, who the next county executive is.
By the way, is Wicomico County essentially Republican? I mean, should one assume that whoever the Republican nominee is more than likely going to pick up the seat, say, in the next turnaround. I know that obviously Paulette may have been the exception.
Right. There are more registered Democrats in the county than there are Republicans, but in terms of turnout, more Republicans turn out for elections. The last Democrat presidential contender to win in Wycombe County was Lyndon Johnson in 1964. So the county has always gone for Republicans on a broad scale. For a long time, the Democrats were in charge, but of course, it was the Southern Democrat idea. And I know when I was growing up, you had to be a Democrat because Democrats controlled Annapolis, and if you wanted to be a game warden or a judge or have any kind of a state job, you had to be a Democrat. You had to be a loyal Democrat. So people who thought Republican were still registered Democrats. That's changed a lot, but I think a Republican always has an edge right now in this county. Now, the city of Salisbury is a completely different thing. The city of Salisbury is very Democratic. So you'd have to kind of, deal with the people in Salisbury and get your votes from the rural area.
Do you think that whoever it is that gets this position is going to chart a new direction, or do you think that there will be some extension from Culver's legacy?
I think it would be a new direction. I think it always is. I don't think any of these people are particularly loyal to Bob Culver. As I said, Andrew even thought about running against him. They're going to do their own thing because when you're the guy, when you're in charge, that's how it's going to be. I think Cannon and Anderton would do it very different ways. I think Anderton would do it big picture. I think Cannon would really get into the minutia. So I think their leadership styles would be different. I think Carl would try to work with the council, certainly. I think Cannon would, too, having come from the council. But then again, Bob Culver came from the council, and he never worked with the council.
I want to turn to something else. There's a landlord's suit against the city over the ordinance they have, amongst other things, preventing rental companies from increasing rents and charging late fees and trying to deal with the eviction issue as a result of the pandemic. What do we know about that at this point?
Well, it's a federal lawsuit, and right now it's landlords in Salisbury, Baltimore City, and I think Howard County. They are all suing over local rules that pertain to rentals. Now, Salisbury's rules are like Baltimore City's and the ones that were implemented by Howard County. We have a lot of landlords here. So of the 23 plaintiffs in the suit, 16 are companies that operate in Salisbury, and they handle about 800, 900 units in Salisbury. The largest is G&I, which you see downtown. They have 285 units. So what they are saying is the city overreached in terms of its regulations on rentals. Now, if you recall when the pandemic first hit, the governor, in his state of emergency, said that you could not evict anybody during this time. The city went further, and the mayor was very adamant on this, and he was very clear about it. His concern was that in the middle of pandemic, he did not want people to become homeless because he was going to have to deal with these people. We're going to have to find some place to put them during a pandemic. And that was going to cause stress to the whole system. People would be thrown in situations where they could possibly spread the virus. I think everyone at that time, we all thought, by September, this thing is going to be over, or October. And it's clear now that it's not. And to the landlords, it's clear that it's not. But among the city's rules was that they could not raise rents during the period. There'd be a moratorium on increasing your rent fees. The landlords just see this as a complete constitutional breach of their ability to conduct business. They're supportive, I think, of the governor's emergency rules about, evictions and things like that. I think that they're okay with the repayment process. The city also has a situation where you would have a timeline to repay back rent that you weren't able to pay during the pandemic. But the landlords want these rules to only apply to people that are obviously affected by COVID, that their jobs or, health is affected by COVID. And they want some kind of proof on that. So they have filed this suit. And I think what's going to happen, the bad thing for me as a reporter is once a suit is filed, no one talks because it's, pending litigation. So I can't get landlords to talk to me. I can't get the city to talk to me anymore because it is a situation where anything they say could be held against them. I have talked to some landlords. I'm surprised, some landlords in Salisbury who are not names in the suit, but they are helping support it financially. They're helping to pay the legal bill. because they're concerned that the city has overreached. So that's the situation. I think there's going to be a negotiation thing. If you read the coverage on this, it seems like they're all going to get together and maybe there will be some concessions or maybe not, or maybe the pandemic goes away and we go to the next stage. But it certainly is kind of a stressful thing. The landlords are pretty unhappy. They were unhappy when this was being done. They felt like they were being ignored, kind of brushed aside. So, yeah, there's a lawsuit.
Did the landlords offered some kind of solution outside of the lawsuit to the fact that this pandemic looks like it's going to be around for a long time, that you may have lots of people who are now renting who can't afford it? I remember, for instance, in Salisbury, I think it's something like 60 or 70% of the housing is rental, which has a tremendous impact then on the city.
Yeah, it's more than 70 now. This is a high rental area. It's funny, you know, when you look at Salisbury, the demographics, I just saw a report the other day about used car sales in Maryland, and we're like number two behind Baltimore. More used cars are sold here in our area than any place, and we have a very high rental thing. Now, I used to think, you know, rentals are bad, you know, everyone should want to own a house, but the new generation, it's really changed. They don't want to own a house. They don't want to deal with a lot of the homeowner things. They just want to pay the extra to have the flexibility to move and go places. So I think our country's changing in terms of rental. You know, the American dream in terms of owning your own house, it's just kind of a pain in the butt to own a house these days. It's easier just to call someone to have things fixed than to have to do it yourself. So anyway, the culture is changing. Salisbury is certainly reflective of that. And it's kind of a battleground in terms of rentals. It's been far worse, of course, in city history. The landlords in the city work together better than ever. But the landlords clearly feel like the city's overstepped on this.
We've been talking with Greg Bassett. He is the editor and general manager of the Salisbury Independent, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Don, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
What I want is immediacy. The nub of the moment pressed without doubt into my side. The tremor that comes sometimes before sight, before taste, or touch. Whatever might be lost, don't take away from me. Stars pouring out of the firmament, not ever holding back the flood over my small ladle. Louisa A. Igloria. In her book, The Buddha Wonders If She's Having a Midlife Crisis. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest today is poet Louisa A. Igloria. Louisa is the recently appointed Poet Laureate of Virginia, an honor well deserved. She is also the author of 14 books of poetry and 4 chapbooks. Originally from Baguio City in the Philippines, Louisa now makes her home with her family in Virginia, where she is professor of creative writing and English at Old Dominion University. From 2009 to 2015, Louisa was also director of the MFA Creative Writing Program at Old Dominion. Louisa's poetry has been published in numerous anthologies and journals in Canada and the UK, as well as Australia and the United States. And finally, she is the winner of numerous poetry and literary prizes here in the US and in the UK. Louisa, congratulations on your selection as Poet Laureate of Virginia. It's an honor to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Hal. I'm very happy to be here. And thank you for all the good words of introduction.
Oh, you're very nice. Thank you. Please tell us what it means to be Poet Laureate of Virginia. What will your responsibilities be? And how will you define your tenure in office? And let me add one more comment. How will the virus and the lockdown affect your work as Poet Laureate?
Right. Well, the position of Virginia Poet Laureate is honorary. There is no compensation. And it was established in 1936. And it was only beginning in 1998, I believe, that the governor appointed a poet laureate from a list of nominees presented by the Poetry Society of Virginia. I read somewhere that the poet laureate should encourage the exchange of arts, information, and perspectives on poetry, but is not actually obligated to write any verse during their tenure, which I thought was interesting. But I got the communication I received from the governor's office telling me that I had been selected included this paragraph, and I quote, "Governor Northam is focused on building a commonwealth that works better for all people, no matter who they are or where they live. During your term, you will assist the governor in solving real problems real people face." So that was kind of like, you know, a bit more definition of the role of Poet Laureate. And I thought about poet Martin Espada, who talks about poetry like bread. And Martin Espada himself has written about the struggles of immigrants, the powerless, those who are considered other in the United States. And then recently, I was reading a story in the Atlantic about former U.S. Poet Laureate Natasha Trethewey, who has a new memoir just out. And she talks there about her ability, about poetry's ability to help us survive grief and trauma. So I think I like this idea, this belief that the laureateship is a unique position for this kind of service and engagement through poetry. And I hope to have many conversations with others to find meaningful ways to support and promote the voices of Virginian poets in particular, and the work of poets and poetry in general as an important part of living in our times. And you mentioned the pandemic, and because of the pandemic, it probably won't be possible to travel through the state for a long while. I know predecessors have given readings across the state, participated in all kinds of programs, given what we are experiencing today, I think that the way to go is through virtual programs such as this, so we can offer programs and workshops and panels and other kinds of poetry events that I hope will center around the theme that other writers have also affirmed, and that is how poetry and creativity are not luxuries, but are necessary for our survival. And the Poetry Society of Virginia, and I am a member also, they spoke recently of wanting to develop a program of youth ambassadors for poetry. And I would like to see how I can also help with that.
And that will be done through a virtual approach as well.
Yes, and I will try to reach out to as many poets and supporters of poetry as I can in the next 2 years.
Well, Louisa, as a poet of color and also an immigrant, what does this appointment mean to you? And also, what does it mean for Virginia?
All right. Well, when immigrant poets of color, and multilingual poets approach prospective publishers, we are often asked how our work would be accessible to the so-called default universal audience. And so sometimes we've been told that our communities are not readers anyway, or that they don't buy books, so why should they publish us? So I'm grateful to the poets of color who have shown the way and who continue to affirm for all of us that our work is important and that our voices matter. So looking at the list of poet laureates on the national level, there have been 23 U.S. poet laureates since 1937. And of the 23 U.S. poets laureate, there are only 5 poets of color. So Rita Dove, Natasha Trethewey, Juan Felipe Herrera, Tracy K. Smith, and our current U.S. poet laureate, Joy Harjo, who is also the first Native American poet laureate. So out of 20 Virginia poets laureate, Rita Dove was also the first African American, both U.S. poet laureate and the first poet laureate for Virginia. And with Sophia Starnes, who is of Spanish and Filipino ancestry, my friend and retired colleague Tim Siebels, and myself, now there are 4 poets of color who have been appointed to this distinguished state laureate position. And I'm very proud to add to that number because I think it also reflects some of the changes which we are seeing everywhere, not just in our country, but also across the globe.
Well, you mentioned that, and let me come back to the last part of that question. How is this appointment and the appointment of poets of color important for Virginia? Why is it important for Virginia that you and other poets of color are recognized?
Well, we know that Virginia is the seat of many important historical markers in our history. And to see that there are poets of color recognized in the slate of poet laureates, I think signifies that we are trying to look more closely at the place of other communities who have often been marginalized in our society, in our culture, and to do something about according them the place that they deserve in this history that we are all supposed to be part of.
Well, you mentioned the default audience. What is the default audience that publishers look for?
Well, I would say it's typically a white audience. And sometimes when poets of color do things like introduce their own vernacular, their own indigenous language and perspectives, it feels as though they have to fight hard to even justify why they're doing that, whereas they should not have to do that.
But what I find interesting for Virginia is that and maybe you just alluded to it, is that poets of color bring a perspective to this default audience that they are not going to get in other places. They bring another outlook, another way of seeing the world. Now, most poets do that out of their own experience and their own insights, but poets of color for this white default audience, it seems to me, would bring a much needed and important perspective to this world. Am I off base here, or is that something that is meaningful to you as a poet of color?
Yes, it is. And I think at heart, what I try to remember is that poetry is really interested in communicating the inexpressible, the places where our feelings are very complex and rich and nuanced, and they can't be neatly labeled as belonging to either just one or the other kind of category. So all of the ways in which our human experiences are shaded by our particular histories and experiences, we bring that to literature, we bring that to our use of language and the writing of our poems. And in that sense, that is probably the more universal base to look at, and not the idea that there is a default culture which predominates, but that is the reality that we experience in publishing, in education, and in other systems that we experience in our culture.
It simply now reflects the reality of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
In your swearing-in ceremony, you said that in this time of pandemic and our isolation, that you were concerned with poetry as witness. What do you mean when you say poetry as witness?
Well, I think what I said was a poetry of active witness was something I wanted to see, that I could work with people to kind of bring this to the foreground. And Tracy K. Smith just said in the slowdown, I think this past Monday, and I quote, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Black lives matter, but it feels wrong to say nothing. And it feels wrong to say nothing, especially during this time when we're seeing an increase in acts of open racism and authoritarianism. It's not right to get into a vehicle purposely to mow down a crowd of peaceful protesters. It's not right to spit in the face of a restaurant or store worker who politely asks you to wear your face mask. It's not right to shoot a 12-year-old carrying a toy gun in a park," and I'm referring to Tamir Rice. "It's not right to shoot a woman asleep in her bed 8 times, I'm referring to Breonna Taylor, "and then produce an incident report stating that she sustained no injuries. It's not right to separate children from their parents whose only so-called crime was to seek asylum in a different country. It's not right to detain hundreds of these migrant children in camps where the facilities don't meet basic standards of care and where the coronavirus is now also rampantly spreading. It's not right to manipulate the law in order to make it easier to arrest people without warrant or detain them without charges or stifle the ability of citizens to speak or write legitimately against the evils and abuses that they see in society." So, you know, I had barely hit my teens in the Philippines when the late dictator Ferdinand Marcos declared martial law. So I remember those times very well. People lived through days and nights of curfew, the constant threat of surveillance, the disappearance of loved ones. When we would hear news of a salvaged body, we knew that this was someone who was not saved or rescued, but rather someone who had been taken away and killed, likely by the military, and then the body dumped somewhere in an alley or in a canal or a river. And today we hear of the more than 25,000, I think now, EJKs or extrajudicial killings in the Philippines under Duterte's regime, with many of the victims young people and children below 5. So the mind tries to wrap itself around these things, and it is just so difficult to make sense of it. In his powerful book, Ilya Kaminsky, whose work I love, his book Deaf Republic describes a fictional town under siege where the people enact resistance through deliberate silence and deafness, and they also resist through art. So one of the characters runs a puppet theater which delivers messages of insurgency. But as far as the poetry of witness phrase goes, I think it may have been the Salvadoran poet Claribel Alegria who was among the first to use this phrase. And American poet Carolyn Forche has translated her work. And Forche also speaks of this kind of poetry as one written in the aftermath of extremity. So it's one, this is a kind of poetry that looks at and describes violence and atrocity in the world, but in describing it, is interested in searching for those traces or evidence of our humanity. And in my acceptance speech, I mentioned that poets who happen to teach in colleges or universities like myself are sometimes viewed as writing a merely academic poetry or a theoretical poetry, and that they're thought to live in some kind of bubble that's separate from real life, but it's just not possible to live in the world and be completely unaffected by what goes on in it. So some people write and make art. Some of us minister to the sick or work in the front lines. Some of us teach. Some organize marches and other public actions. Nevertheless, there are many different ways to witness, which is just another way to say that what we really need to do is to try to find ways to do and say what's right.
Well, I certainly understand that. And you also mentioned that you wanted to write poetry or express what it means to take care of the other. Mm-hmm. And say something about that. And then you read a poem. Would you share that with us, Louisa?
Yeah, certainly. I had read a poem called Ode to the Hand Wrapped Around the Achilles Heel. And as we know, the reference is to the story of the Greek hero Achilles, who during the Trojan War killed the Trojan prince Hector. And all of this sets off a retaliatory cycle of violence. But in recalling that story, I wanted to focus on not just the big moments of heroism or struggle. In those narratives, those are the things that are usually what you look at first. But there are those other moments of heroism and in internal tension that are more subdued or that aren't given as much screen time. And maybe it's because I have children, but I'm riveted by the figure of Achilles' mother and how she held him by the heel as an infant and dipped him into the river Styx when he was a baby, right? Because she wanted to protect him from harm. So that gesture of wanting to shield someone, because we know that pain and suffering are, you know, pretty unbearable things, and we would like to not have the people we love the most, especially, have to experience those kinds of things. So all of that went into the poem that I wrote, which is not really about Achilles, but goes and looks at some of those features of the story that speak to this idea of wanting to shield someone, to protect someone, to try and provide security.
Well, read that for us, Louisa, right, if you would.
I'll do that. Ode to the hand wrapped around the Achilles heel. Good husband material, her aunt's assessment. Watching her fiancé help his parents navigate the narrow staircase from the gallery, where they've gone to an art opening. He goes out in the rain to get the car, which he parked at the end farthest from both entrance and exit, lessening the off chance a lorry or fire truck or other large vehicle might loose its brakes, swerve from the road and ram into theirs. Over the years, she comes to learn how certain habits and the ways he likes to do things are driven by a combination of fear, planning, and precision, even if, or perhaps because, most things are outside the realm of total human jurisdiction. In the Iliad, their son in her arms, Andromache pleads with Hector not to go back to fight in a war that he opposes. But he is the kind of man for whom duty to country is synonymous with obligation to family. He will do what he can to prevent their being taken as spoils of war or slaves. Homer writes, "A thousand campfires gleamed upon the plain. When it is his time to go, he only wants to go with honor. Because victors in any kind of war don't always have compassion." Achilles gloats, not only calling on dogs and vultures to desecrate the corpse of his enemy, but also slitting his heel tendons, passing leather thongs through them before dragging Hector's body in the dust. This story is meant to illustrate weakness in any figure, victor or victim. Thus, every human fear of the end is a wish to protect, to render secure, if not invincible, whoever is in their care. Here is the ankle held fast in the mother's hand, the one blind spot her love kept dry from the waters of the underworld. Here is the rain that falls on all their heads with not a shield in sight. And always someone who volunteers to go first or last.
You're beautiful, Louisa. You gave us a little bit of your sense of this poem at the beginning of it in television talk they call the setup. But I wonder if you would come back to it again and talk to us for a moment about what you were trying to create with this poem.
I think I wanted to create a connection to stories that seem only mythical or only stories, but that we actually see constantly played out in different versions in, you know, many different parts of our lives. So it's also, it's a mythological story, but it's also a very domestic and familiar story to us. If you're a parent, you know what it means to agonize over the safety of your children, and vice versa. If children, you know, worry about their parents, they also wish to do things to protect them, especially in the pandemic. We're seeing a lot of that with, you know, we are being warned to stay away from those who are immunocompromised, because just being around them, even if you're young and healthy, could put them in jeopardy. So it's this idea of keeping an eye out for the other, which is the cornerstone of empathy, I think.
Well, it's also, I would suggest, it's also the cornerstone of community. And the cornerstone of how we make a creative society. So back to the pandemic, we have never been more in a place. It seems to me, and I'll ask your thought, in a place where we need more to care for each other. And it goes down to the simplest things, like wearing your mask, keeping yes. your distance. I mean, these are mundane things now, but it's interesting that in the severity of this pandemic, we have to talk about the mundane now as things we must do.
For sure. And they seem very basic, simple things, but on some level, they seem maybe the hardest to do, because I think a lot has also happened in modern societies, so that we feel like maybe it's harder to get in touch with our feelings because there's so much distraction and noise around us. And I think what this pandemic period has done is to, again, strip away all the unessential things and force us to look at what's truly important.
Luis, I know you publish, in addition to your books, you publish a bit online. Would you tell our listeners where they might find your poetry online?
Yes, for nearly 10 years now, I write daily poems, sometimes more than one, but I post only one poem a day. And these are ongoing works in progress. And this is a blog for poetry, which was founded by poet and publisher Dave Bonta. So you can find it at vianegativa.us. No spaces in between via and negativa. So what my daily writing practice has done is to give me a way to, I think poetry is really my favorite way to process my thoughts. I go there to work out things that I happen to be thinking about. I don't have any fixed time of day when I come to this. I don't have any fixed subject in mind, but I try to just engage, you know, my whole being, my thinking, my feeling in the act of looking for language to express what it is that I'd like to give voice to.
Luisa, I want to congratulate you again on your appointment as Poet Laureate of Virginia, and thank you for joining me today on Delmarva Today. And I want to thank all of you for listening. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.